And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Peter Cooper to the program today. Peter was a longtime music writer for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. In addition to teaching at Vanderbilt University and being a performing and recording artist, Peter is now a senior director, producer, and writer at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. Today we'll be talking about his new book, Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride, Lasting Legends and Untold Adventures in Country Music, which is published by Springhouse Press. Peter, you start off with a one-of-a-kind original, who's from Memphis, appropriately enough, Cowboy Jack Clement.
Yeah, he's my favorite. I think the first sentence in the book is, we should probably start with the cowboy. He's the one you should have met. He was from, I guess, Whitehaven and spent tons of time in Memphis and was at 706 Union for the around the time of the birth of rock and roll, and he was there to engineer the Million Dollar Quartet sessions. But thankfully for those of us in Middle Tennessee, he wound his way to Nashville ultimately and discovered Charlie Pride and invented the music that we now call Americana. And he had a house on Belmont Avenue that was the creative nerve center for Nashville. And everybody had a key, and nobody really needed a key because the door was open, the kitchen door. And he built a studio there. He said, yeah, come to figure that the worst place in the world to make music might be in a professional recording studio. So he built a home studio, and it was just his playground. And you never knew who was going to be over there. It could be Johnny Cash or Waylon Jennings or Bono. And he was a man of whimsy and creativity.
It's a shame he only released a couple of his own albums.
That's right. He released three solo albums. One posthumous, so two during his life. And it is a shame because he was the greatest at phrasing. And when you hear Charlie Pride in that fantastic vocal phrasing, a lot of that is from the cowboy. A lot of that is from learning the way the cowboy's voice sounded on his own demo tapes. And it's funny, he was called Cowboy even though he was frightened of horses and never wore boots. Had a song called Some Cowboys Hate Horses. Some cowboys hate horses, and I'm one of those. I stole the title of the book from him, Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride. He had a song that said, if I had Johnny's cash and Charlie's pride, I wouldn't have a buck owing on my car. I don't know. Seemed like the thing to do.
I was a little disappointed there wasn't a bigger Charlie Pride story. You got a good section on cash, but
I don't have any great Charlie Pride stories other than the discovery stories that I've gotten from Cowboy Jack. I've met Charlie Pride and interviewed him. He's not particularly loquacious, and he told his story in a really good autobiography. I didn't want the book to be a history book. There's a lot of history books and some really, really good ones about country music. I wanted this to reveal characters, and thus I focused on a lot of people that I really knew.
And there's a little bit of scandalous stuff in the book. Did you ever feel, since you're a big shot at the Country Music Hall of Fame, that you were working at cross purposes there?
Well, I'm not a big shot. I play utility infield at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, but I don't think there was anything so scandalous that I'd be too worried about it. I don't think there's anything that I revealed in the book that I wouldn't have talked about with the principal offenders.
How did you start dancing about architecture?
Dancing about architecture, which is a derisive phrase for writing about music. Somebody said, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. It's just a ridiculous endeavor. I don't think it's a ridiculous endeavor. I think it can be informative and even helpful if somebody does it right. But I started when I was finishing up in college. I was a huge music fan, and roots music fan in particular, and singer-songwriter fan most especially. I loved Guy Clark, Townes Van Zandt, Eric Taylor, people like that. And my college writing professor was supposed to go review a Guy Clark show in Asheville, North Carolina, for a weekly newspaper. And my college professor got sick, and he called me and said, hey, you're the only guy in Spartanburg, South Carolina that I know that knows all the Guy Clark songs and can conjugate verbs. Can you go do this for me? It's like, what, you want me to go review Guy Clark? You know, this grizzled veteran hero of American song. And he said, yeah, they'll let you in for free. And so I said, hey, that sounds really good. And I went to review the Guy Clark show, and I learned a little lesson at that show. When I went, I thought I was there to decide in my 22-year-old prose whether Guy Clark was really good or not, I guess. You know, I was supposed to pass judgment, which is ridiculous. But when I got to the show, Guy Clark was playing with his son, Travis Clark. Travis was playing bass, Guy was playing acoustic. And it was a nice show. And this guy showed up at the club and got a little tipsy, got real emotional. In the middle of the show, starts going, "I wish Guy Clark was my daddy. I wish Guy Clark was my daddy." And I wound up writing that into the review and got a call from the editor. I said, "Did that really happen?" I was like, yeah, you can ask anybody. It really happened. And he said, "Hey, Jimmy Dale Gilmore is coming to town next week. Do you want to write about that?" And so it let me know that the editor was liking something that I was doing. And I figured out that what I had done quite accidentally was just to attempt to convey not the facts of the matter and not some sort of heavy-handed opinion. You know, I wasn't the judge of the music. I was just conveying the power of the music, that Guy Clark's songs are enough to make somebody question the tyranny of lineage. That's probably a more interesting thing to try to write into an article.
We'll have a lot of these asides to the story. I remember when I went into the music store and saw the Flatlanders reissue had just come out on Rounder, and I just freaked out because I was so happy to finally have a copy of that legendary record.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a treasure.
One of the most inexplicable incidents in the book is when Bob Dylan decided to diss Tom T. Hall and Merle Haggard in 2015. What did he say, and has anyone ever figured out why he said that?
I think he was accepting an award from the Neris folks, the folks who put the Grammys on. And he implied that when Kris Kristofferson came to Nashville, that people like Tom T. Hall were upset by this, and those people were controlling the game. It was inexplicable because Tom T., at the time when Kristofferson came to town, the first real-deal songwriter that Kristofferson had much human interaction with, although he did meet Cowboy Jack Clement on his first day in town, but was Tom T. Hall. And we were in a bar, and Kristofferson came over wearing a necklace and bearing a beer for Tom T., and, "Are you Tom Hall?" "Yeah, I like your songwriting. I'm Kris Kristofferson. I'm trying to be a songwriter, too." And Tom T. said, "Well, pleased to meet you. It's a hairy-legged town." But Dylan specifically criticized a song called "I Love" that was a hit for Tom T. And that song was actually written with kids in mind. It was not supposed to be some sort of elevated song. It was also written to ease Tom T. Hall's mind. He had gone to a therapist. He was having trouble and feeling bad, and the therapist said, "Well, why don't you write down a list of all the things that are making you upset?" And he did that, and that made him more upset. So he decided instead he would write down the list of all the things he loves. That included, you know, little fuzzy pups and, well, bourbon in the glass. That line's probably not a favorite with kids, but in any case, Tom T. Hall, along with Kris Kristofferson and John Hartford, changed the language of country music in really interesting ways. And I don't know why Dylan would have lumped Tom T. in with a group that was in charge and not wanting things to change. Tom T.'s the opposite of that. I don't know Bob Dylan. I can't think of anybody as empathetic and caring and kind and intelligent as Tom T., and I do know him pretty well. So I wouldn't put him down.
And he chose not to hit back at Dylan, really, either.
Yeah. Well, he said, what in the world was that all about, was his main comment.
Well, and the fact that Dylan also dissed Haggard, which just...
Yeah, I don't understand that. Dylan toured with Haggard as well. But, you know, sometimes I think Dylan might just say stuff just to
get a reaction.
Just to say it, just to get a reaction. I'm thankful for him. Regardless, you know, talk about somebody who changed language. What's wild is a lot of the things that Dylan did help make it possible for Kristofferson and Tom T. and John Hartford to change things in Nashville. I love Bob Dylan. I was just listening last night to Old Crow Medicine Show's revisiting of Dylan's Blonde on Blonde album, which he recorded in 1966 in Nashville.
Ketch stopped by the studio a few months ago when his wife had her new book out.
That's a great book, isn't it? Lydia Peele.
Yeah, and her first collection of short stories blew me away. The Reasons for and Advantages of Breathing, one of my favorite short story collections ever.
She is something. She just invents worlds in her mind and then sets them on paper.
You mentioned I Love by Tom T. Hall. That was on Songs of Fox Hollow, mm-hmm. and that was the very first LP I had when I was a kid.
Hmm. Wow.
And, of course, you have a personal connection to that record, too.
I do. I love that record, and that was something that, when I was a kid, that came out in, I think, in 74. And that's one that I can remember liking and my dad liking and my granddad liking. It had the song I Love on it. It had a song called Sneaky Snake.
You're going to drink all your root beer.
That's right. It had a song called I Care. And it was beautiful in its inception. Tom T. had a couple of nephews hanging around his home, Fox Hollow, for a summer, and they kept asking him questions about the farm, and he kept trying to answer those questions. Then the answers started to rhyme, and he came up with an entire album geared towards, as he said, listeners of all ages, which was a remarkable thing to do at the time. If you think of somebody at the very top of country music game, stopping what they're doing, going to a record label and saying, this next thing of mine is a kid's record. I don't think that's going to happen with the next Chris Stapleton record.
Although, I know, but when you're putting out two or three LPs a year back in that time.
That's right. Well, that is true. There were a lot more albums made in that time. You mentioned Merle Haggard. I mean, he had 30 albums of mostly original material in the first 9 years of his career. These days, it's about an album every 3 years would be a norm. But anyway, I loved that Songs of Fox Hollow album when I was a kid, and then I found out in 2010 that I was going to have a kid of my own and decided to bring a bunch of my friends over to Tom T's home, Fox Hollow, and with this kid of mine who was 8 weeks old at the time, and we got Jim Lauderdale and Buddy Miller and Patty Griffin and Bobby Bear and Tommy Cash and a bunch of just neat people to redo the songs of Fox Hollow with Tom T sitting right there as we were doing them and watching from the control room. And it made Patty Griffin nervous. She was singing the song I Love, and Tom T's sitting there watching her do it, and she goes, I'm so nervous. I was like, well, why? She said, well, what if I forget a lyric? And Tom T says, don't worry about it, darling. If you forget something, just make it up. That's what I did. And that is what he did. He wrote that song in 5 minutes. It's a 2-minute song. He recorded 2 takes of it and has sold millions. So that's some of the most effective 9 minutes of Tom T's life spent on that song. Plus the 2 it took Patty to cut it. Man, it's amazing to be in the studio. I was co-producing that album with my friend Eric Brace, but I was also playing on it, and I was sitting right next to Patty as she was singing that song in a vocal booth, but I was playing acoustic guitar. It's pretty amazing to be in a studio setting and hearing somebody that great as they're creating something that's going to go down in perpetuity. Hearing it, the immediacy of it and the power and the beauty of it is something to behold. I think sometimes people think music is a workmanlike endeavor, and sometimes it is, but that's when you're messing up.
Oh, yeah, what were Cowboy Jack's rules for recording?
Oh, yeah. Remember, boys, we're in the fun business. If we're not having fun, we're not doing our jobs. I nearly called the book The Fun Business.
But how could it be The Fun Business if Billy Sherrill was essentially Phil Spector South?
Well, Billy had some fun, too. He sure did. Billy Sherrill brought in this, what we now call country-politan production, very layered kind of production in the 70s, but he was doing it with George Jones and Tammy Wynette. Billy was also writing and co-writing a lot of great songs, but he had fun. Billy Sherrill was a wrestling aficionado. He was big into pro wrestling, which I know there's quite a history of that in Memphis. But it was a different kind of fun for Billy. But he
described himself as right of Attila the Hun.
Yeah, that's probably an understatement. But he was an interesting guy. Takes all kinds to make a world.
Now, talking about that magic thing that happens, you say in the book that Leanne Womack has the most spectacular voice you've heard in person.
Oh, man.
And you
yeah.
managed to give her a backhanded compliment.
Yeah,
that went south real bad.
That got me in trouble. She is a spectacular singer, Leanne Womack, is, and was under a lot of pressure to make albums that worked in the commercial marketplace. And that's not always about being great. Like it, in sports, if you pour in 35 points a night and dominate all over the hardwood, you know, you're LeBron James and you get paid a whole lot of money to do that. And in sports, the people who are technically the best at it wind up reaping the rewards. A lot of things are that way. In music, that's not necessarily so. The best guitar player in Nashville is a guy that almost nobody listening here would have ever heard of. A guy named Rory Hoffman, who's spectacular musician, but just being spectacular doesn't mean that the Brinks truck shows up at your door and dumps a bunch of cash. So Leanne had that struggle to make albums, put that fantastic voice to commercial use. And she had a breakthrough album that was nearly universally praised. Had a song on it, There's More Where That Came From, and everybody was calling it her career album, you know, the best that she would ever do. And I wrote about it when I was writing for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville, and I had to write reviews, and I wrote about it kindly, you know, I thought, but also said, hey, people are saying this is a career album. This is not a career album. That implies that she'll never do something this good, and she will. She'll do better. And moreover, on the second half of the album, there's a couple of song selections that are iffy, and the pacing gets a little messy, something. So I'm down in Atlanta the day that review came out and got a phone call from Leanne Womack.
Peter Cooper?
Yeah, Leanne, this is late at night, you know. Where are you? I'm in Atlanta. You get over here right now. What? Why? I can't. But what? You get over here right now, because I'm going to give you 3 swift kicks to the groin. You said this in my career album. And the conversation devolved from there. The next time I saw Leanne Womack in person, I did not jump in the car and drive from Atlanta to Nashville to receive 3 swift kicks to the groin. But the next time I saw her was at the Country Music Association Awards, which was held that year in New York City. And we were at Madison Square Garden backstage, and she came through with a big troop of people, and she was holding a trophy that designated that album CMA Top Album of the Year, which is something that if you do a career album, sometimes you might get an award like that. But anyway, I thought she wouldn't see me because of all the clamor backstage and the high-toned settings, and she just looked at me and made the stop signal with her hand and then pointed at me and then kind of spread 2 fingers apart and said, Peter Cooper, spread them. Oh, no. But later on, she bought me a T-shirt that said, I took 3 swift kicks to the groin and all I got was this lousy T-shirt.
Did she ever make a record, do you think, that eclipsed that one?
Yeah, I think her latest album is, I would say that it does, and she would say that it does as well. Although I do think there's a fallacy in putting a scoreboard to all these things. And I used to really...
You address that a lot during the course of the book.
Yeah, I used to get hung up on that. And, you know, there really isn't a best. Sometimes you want to listen to plaintive story songs from Tom T. Hall, and sometimes you want to hear from a brutally effective Queens, New York band called the Ramones.
I've started in my personal life, instead of using words like best, just saying favorite. So at the end of the year, I come up with a favorite book list, and I just say, these are my favorites.
That's great. That works, and that's true. Yeah, these things are not alike at all. Again, if they're any good, they're nothing allike. You can't say, Emmy Lou Harris is better than Kris Kristofferson. These are 2 very different things, and they're wonderful for different reasons, and I like them both a whole lot. Again, it's real different from sports. I used to get angry about music that I didn't like, and I know a lot of people who get angry about music that they don't like, and one day discovered that you could just, if there's music that you don't like that's actually making your blood pressure rise, you could just listen to something else if you want, or go out for a sandwich.
I was dating a woman who's a big Dylan fan. I'm not particularly a big Dylan fan. I love the Christmas album. No one else likes that Christmas album, but I do. But I'm a big fan of Slayer, the heavy metal band. And she just kept saying Slayer were terrible. I said, well, you know, I'm glad you have Dylan and you can enjoy him.
Yeah.
And I thought it was funny. Me, the heavy metal fan, was telling her, you know, just relax. You know, just let people enjoy what they want to.
Or say what Dylan would say. The sky's not yellow, it's chicken.
Now, you talked about the award show that you ran into Leanne Womack at. How many more award shows will it take for there to be too many award shows?
Oh, there's way too many award shows, I do think. Tom T. Hall, again, wise man, talking about award shows, says, yeah, you get informed one day that you're in a contest. Then you have to show up and react to losing it or winning it or what have you. They're weird. That said, there is a cachet to them. People complain about the Grammy Awards, and again, it's using a scoreboard for something where there's really no score. But the one time I got nominated for a Grammy and got to go out to LA for it, I can tell you, it was neat. You feel like you're sitting at the adult table or something. But no, there's way too many award shows, but it's just television usually dictates that. Although some of my favorite award shows aren't on television. The Bluegrass Awards from Raleigh are wonderful, and we don't get to watch them on TV.
You talk about the double-edged sword nature of meeting your heroes, and some people say it's a good idea, and some people, of course, say it's not a good idea to meet your heroes. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the story of Ira Leuven being Ira Leuven when Elvis Presley walked up to him is...
Oh, yeah. Ooh. I never met Ira Leuven. I met Charlie Leuven, and Charlie, till the day he died, was angry about Ira Leuven's behavior to Elvis. When Elvis came out of Memphis, nobody knew what to call what he was doing or where to place it. So initially, he was touring with country acts, played the Grand Ole Opry, was told by a manager at the Grand Ole Opry that he should go back to Memphis and drive that Crown Electric truck because he didn't have any future in music. The Opry, by giving him the old heave-ho, really put itself at risk. Had they brought Elvis in, then these millions of Elvis fans would have been intrigued by coming to the Opry. As it stood, a lot of country fans of the day went off and followed Elvis, and the Opry was a third full on a lot of nights. Yeah, Elvis was backstage. He was playing a bill with the Leuven brothers, Charlie and Ira Leuven, one of the most compelling harmony duos in country music history. But Ira was bad to take a nip every now and then, or more than every now and then, and get angry when he did. Elvis was playing gospel music backstage, trying to impress the Leuven brothers because he was such a huge fan, and his mother was a huge Leuven brothers fan.
Because they had played on the radio here in Memphis for years and years.
That's right. And if Elvis's mother was a fan of something, Elvis was a fan of that because he just wanted to impress his mom, loved his mother. He was playing that gospel music backstage on a piano, and he said, well, this is the music I love. This is what I'd do if I had my way. And Ira snipped back at him and used language that we won't use on the radio or anywhere else, but, you know, just criticized his art and the derivation of it. That was rough for Elvis. I know it had to hurt in the moment, being sort of verbally punched by a hero as Ira Leuven was to him. And that's a dangerous spot to be in. And Charlie Leuven thought that it probably kept Elvis from recording a bunch of Leuven Brothers songs, so it could have made them a lot of money. But I do write in the book about how generally, yeah, I was told to never meet my heroes because they would disappoint. And I found the opposite to be true in just about every case, especially when those people are singer-songwriters, when they're people who are writing their hearts, you know, and conveying intelligence and empathy and intellectual curiosity. You can't make that stuff up. You can't be Kris Kristofferson without being smart and wise and funny and empathetic. And so I've found that some of the people that I most respect, like Kristofferson or John Prine or Tom T. Hall, they've been some of the most helpful and kind people that I've run into.
But Kristofferson seemed almost determined to make his own life as hard as possible.
Yeah, Kristofferson was great at everything. He was a college football player. He was a Golden Gloves boxer. He was a wrestler. He had short stories published in the Atlantic Monthly. As a young man, he was an Army Ranger. He was a Rhodes Scholar. Everything this guy touched turned to gold. And he said, yeah, I mean, in my 20s, my parents thought that if I didn't at least wind up Secretary of State or something, that I'd sort of blown it. The one thing he really couldn't do was sing. And one thing that he hadn't done much of, except for funny songs in the military, was to write songs. And he ditched his whole military career. He'd been given an appointment at West Point. He told me that he had accepted that and that he was told that he would have to submit lesson plans to teach at West Point at the beginning of the semester. And he said that was the most frightening thing he'd heard, submitting lesson plans, you know, telling somebody what he was going to be doing 2 months from now, scared him to death. And right after getting scared to death with that, he came down to Nashville just to see it and experience it. First night in Nashville, met Cowboy Jack Clement, and they talked about hopping trains, and they talked about the music business. And then a couple nights later, he got taken backstage at the Opry, Christopherson did, and he was able to meet Johnny Cash. Said he was prowling around backstage like a panther. And then he realized in meeting Cowboy Jack Clement and Johnny Cash that he'd never met people more fiercely creative or intelligent. And this is a guy who'd been around fiercely creative, intelligent people his whole life. And he determined he would move to Nashville and become what he called a songwriting bum, and took a job sweeping up at a recording studio, started drinking too much and wrecking his 50cc motorcycle all along Music Row, and screwed up a marriage. In the midst of all that, actually became Kris Kristofferson, one of the greatest songwriters that's ever lived. Everything that that guy had touched turned to gold, and he was like, well, how about this pile that I can step in over here? Let me try that. And it worked out. What a life.
Now, another songwriter who couldn't sing very well is the legendary Shel Silverstein. That story with him and Bobby Bear in the hotel room.
Shel Silverstein, boy, talk about a guy who could do anything. I mean, Shel Silverstein wrote children's stories, Where the Sidewalk Ends, and The Giving Tree. Boy, that's the saddest children's story ever written, The Giving Tree. I love Shel Silverstein. I'll never show that to my son. It's just years of therapy come from ingesting that story, The Giving Tree. But he also wrote dirty cartoons for Playboy, and he hung around at the Playboy Mansion, lived there a lot of the time, and he wrote songs like A Boy Named Sue. But he had just this howling, cackling voice. It's just somebody shoved a whole bunch of razor blades down his throat, and then
Wolfman Jack with a cold.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I mean, I won't even do a good Shel Silverstein impression here because I don't want to scare anybody away. And there might be kids listening. But Bobby Bear, great Country Music Hall of Fame singer-songwriter and mostly a lover of songs. Bear will go anywhere in search of a song. And he loved Shel Silverstein because of that. He actually made what a lot of folks think of as the first album of what we now call the outlaw movement in the 70s in country music. Where he produced it, and it was all Shel Silverstein songs. He just loved him. But Bear said, yeah, I used to rent me a motel room for a few nights and have different songwriters come in and just play songs. And in there, we'd been in there all day just playing songs, just looking for songs. And then Shel come in early in the evening and just starts playing a song. And just as soon as he starts playing it, some woman is just banging on the wall, going, shut up, will you shut up? I said, Shel, you're a terrible singer. I love you, but you're awful.
Now, of course, there's always the hand-wringing in country music about preserving the heritage, but also looking toward the future. And it seems Nashville itself is fighting that battle, that even Music Row now is susceptible to the transformation and gentrification of the city. It seems like it's going to be really hard to maintain that kind of artist vibe for the town.
Yeah, I think it's something that any successful city, and Nashville is now a successful city, something that any successful city struggles with. And in Nashville, you've got a city that was built on music, tried for a while to call it the Athens of the South and get people to come visit a fake Acropolis on West End Avenue, and that didn't turn the tourists on. But what did turn people on was the music and the creators of that music. And it is a tough scenario now because when you're a creator of music, you're probably not moving into town with a few hundred thousand to pop down on a condo. And so the very people who created the culture that made those condos go up are the ones that are being priced out of it and having to move north and south and east of the town. But in terms of the music changing in its sounds, I don't worry too much about that. I find that people are complaining about whatever happened to good country music of any sort that they liked, whether it's honky-tonk music that was played by people like Ernest Tubb in the 40s and 50s, or whether it was the outlaw sounds that were popularized by Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson in the 70s, or no matter what it is, it never goes away. It's recorded for posterity, so you can listen to it. Nothing happens to your record collection because of something you hear on the radio that you don't like. And we have the entire scope of popular music available to us at our fingertips. But also, it's going on now. There's a guy named John Byrd in Nashville who's as good a hillbilly singer as anything that I've ever heard. Last time I saw him play, there were 20 people on a Tuesday night there to see him. If we care about this stuff enough to complain about it, then we should go seek the good stuff that's out there. You can find it and probably find it for free on the internet, but listen to who these people are and what they're doing and then go out and check them out.
But that free instant culture of the internet has kind of made things less valuable even in digesting them and holding on to them, because you remember going to the record store to get a single or a CD later on, and that was a big purchase for a person back then, and you would listen to that record nonstop for months.
And there was an ownership to it. You know, when Elvis, as a teenager, was going down to Poplar Tunes and trying to get turned on to these new sounds, I think he felt like when he bought a record that he owned it in some way, and I don't think people growing up now are thinking of it in that same sense. But I don't know what to do about it. On the one hand, when I was a teenager, I was having to go to record stores and order things. You know, they would get some kind of German compilation of country
Bear
music,
stuff.
Bear Family thing. Yeah, and I'd have to wait for it, and then you'd get the call that it was in, and
it was like $100.
Yeah, and it was exciting. Now you just punch it in on the keyboard. But there's a chapter in this book about a really wise guy named Don Light, and one thing that Don Light said all the time, some kind of calamitous sequence of events had occurred, he would say, well, you can't unscramble eggs, and that's the way it is with the internet. I could walk around furrowing my brow about streaming services and the lack of money I get as a songwriter from those things, but you can't unscramble eggs. And the only thing you can do is sit down and write a song or write a story about people who sit down and write songs.
And looking at your CV, I don't know how you'd have time to do anything. You're writing books, you're a musician, songwriter, have a great family, have a very demanding job. I mean, how do you get anything done?
Well, the family's not all that great. I teach about music at Vanderbilt University's Blair School of Music as well. I find that while I'll admit to the occasional, hopefully benign neglect of family obligations, everything else that I do is tied into music in some very real way. So it all feels like one thing. Sitting down to write this book was easy after days spent at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum being surrounded by the history of all of this and by these palpable genius hillbilly ghosts. It was on my mind already. And I find that songs come in spurts at the same time that stories are coming in spurts. It just mind gets in a place like that. Everybody does lots of different kinds of things. I get lucky to get sometimes paid for some of the different kinds of things that I do, but they're all linked together, and there are people who water ski on the weekends.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Hey, it's great to talk to you. This is such a good place to be and good company to be in. Thank you.
Peter Cooper is the author of Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride, Lasting Legends and Untold Adventures in Country Music, which is published by Springhouse Press. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WYPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.